Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Impeachment articles at last make their way from the House to the Senate, accompanied by a familiar divide.
He will be held accountable. He has been held accountable. He has been impeached.
These delay tactics were self-serving, hypocritical, and discrediting.
David Gergen served under four presidents, two who faced impeachments. We'll get his perspective. Red Sox ownership insists that the decision to part ways with manager Alex Cora was mutual.
Alex came to the conclusion that he could not effectively lead the organization going forward, and we came to that conclusion as well.
What happens now as the Sox scramble to replace him? And the Democrats debated last night. At just 19 days before the Iowa caucus, we're in the thick of it now. What did you think? We'll talk about it and take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A somber moment for the nation today as the House formally voted to send two articles of impeachment to the Senate. But the moment came with a familiar divide.
He will be held accountable. He has been held accountable. He has been impeached. He's been impeached forever. They can never erase that.
These delay tactics were self-serving, hypocritical, and discrediting. But they made an important admission. Some might even call it a concession. You proved a very big point. Democrats do not even believe their case was robust enough to win in a trial.
First, you had House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as she named the seven Democrats who will manage and prosecute the impeachment case against President Trump in the Senate. And then an hour later, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy from the House floor. So we're at this historic juncture. How do we make sense of things? How do we weigh the charges and the countercharges in this highly charged moment in our history? Well, we are lucky enough to have someone in Studio 3 who can help us do just that, because he's got a view, honestly, unlike anyone else in the country. He's advised four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, been part of award-winning news teams, and he's the founding co-director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor. David Gergen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, TC.
Impeachment. The trial's moving forward now. We got some new information today. We got the managers. We got the vote to send it over. What is your biggest takeaway from today?
From today, I think the solemnity of the occasion. You know, this has been in the foreground and background, floating around in our minds now for a long time. And to some extent, I think that people began turning away and looking on beyond these impeachment and prosecution decisions. But today brought it all back and showed us we are in serious territory here. This is only the third time in the nation's entire history when we've had a trial in the Senate that to remove a sitting president. The odds against the vote, the odds against removal, of course, are very, very high. But even so, at a moment like this, when new documents and new evidence is being showered upon us, you can't help but think these are serious times and they deserve to be taken with respect for the traditions of the office and a lot of tolerance for the degree to which tensions are so high and people are going to say things that are going to be outrageous, and we just sort of have to move right on through it and continue working with the essence of the case, and that is whether Donald Trump committed impeachable acts that deserve his ouster.
How serious are the stakes, David? How serious are they? How do we really get our minds around that?
Well, we would be in much, much safer territory if, in fact, we were repeating the Clinton impeachment of some years ago. That impeachment, as serious as it was, basically at the end of the process, the senators applauded the people who wrote the rules. There was 100-0 vote. There was a sense of the country coming together, and Clinton was able to continue governing, and actually his numbers by the time he left office were up to 64% approval. That did not tear the country apart. I think that this whole process, this impeachment and now the trial are going to tear further at the fabric that holds us together. and I think make it harder for the country to heal. I think much people are going to be in the next, this coming election in November, I think will look for candidates who can heal, whether the Democrats can find the right person who can also meet the other qualifications people have, I think is a big, big question at this moment. So there is a, there's good reason to be a somber. We can celebrate the fact that our checks and balances are working, but somber at the prospects for a country that's coming apart.
You know, as I thought about having you with your particular perspective and the breadth and the depth of that on air today, I kind of thought about, okay, what can we ask you that we can't ask other people who might sit in that
chair?
You
mean, what was it like in Andrew Johnson's
impeachment? I trust that you were actually not there for that one.
I'll get to see
on. Well, what kept coming back into my head was, how bad is it, right? There are a number of different things happening in the world, and it feels like we are in a moment where we are unmoored or unanchored from a deep gut-level ability to compare that to previous experience and process things as they're happening in terms of how bad is it. Yeah. So, for example, it does feel like we have a divide right now that is staggering, but we've been divided before. How bad is it?
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, we're so privileged to have her in our midst here in Boston. You know, she argues that, we're more divided now than we have at any time since the 1850s.
That's terrifying.
And of course, it is terrifying because, of course, that led to the war itself. I remember coming home from a Democratic and Republican conventions covering them in 2004 and telling my wife, after going to those two conventions and hear how vituperative they were and how they, each side demonized the other, for the first time I could begin to understand how this country had a civil war. Mm. There is that sense now that, you know the evidence that how many people now on each side would be very unhappy if their son or daughter married somebody from a family on the other side. That's the kind of prelude to a country that's no longer a united country. You know, there are people who seriously, if they could, would separate out again.
You have studied public leadership. You've been in public leadership. So given what you just said, what is the moment demand of our public leaders?
I think that the moment demands of our public leaders that they go back to fundamentals, they stop making debating points, stop personalizing this, but rather try to help us get through it as a country and put the principles of unity and that think of the Constitution as our binding document and try to stick with the traditions. Frankly, my hope is that as perilous as his journey may be, I think that having the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding over these proceedings in robes, John Roberts, a lot of pressure on him, but I think he will come to represent the symbol of the Constitution itself. He's there in that capacity.
He'll embody it.
Yes, he'll embody the Constitution. And to be fair to him, he's not my favorite justice. But nonetheless, I do think he's shown more respect for the traditions of the law and the traditions of the Constitution than an ideologue would. He has not been as ideological as I feared to say. And on the health care, the Obamacare case in particular, he tried to save Obamacare in effect because I think he felt it was being railroaded out. And that's why I'm looking to him symbolically as an important figure in this. We'll see how it goes.
Did the House respect the Constitution in the way it executed its role in this impeachment process? And is the Senate respecting the Constitution?
I thought the House, and Nancy Pelosi in particular, was wise to wait, that she didn't want to be stampeded into an impeachment proceeding. It was only when the evidence came out that of the phone call between Trump and the head of Ukraine, that the numbers on her caucus really started to rise, and in particular, new veterans in Congress decided on going. Having said that, I did not think the Democrats were as wise as they should have been in bringing the Republicans more fully into the process of how this was going to be carried out.
Could they have?
Yes, I think they should have, and I do not think that they did. Well, that the traditions have been that leaders sit down together and figure out what the rules are going to be, that people see witnesses, they have access to documents quickly. And I know there were reasons why the Democrats did not think the White House was stonewalling. So the blame doesn't entirely go on the Democrats. But I did think from the beginning there was poison in the system more than there should have been. And I think we still are facing that. And so the process, I thought the Democrats could have found ways to give the Republicans less room for saying this was being railroaded. And it would take away one of their main arguments against.
I want to pull some sound here that kind of supports that. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy criticizing Speaker Pelosi for delaying the proceedings, and he did this earlier today.
Instead of sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate for trial, Speaker Pelosi held them hostage in a failed play to gain leverage that she did not and would never have. In terms of concessions, she got nothing. No control, no moral victories. In other words, another failed strategy.
Obviously, you had said that you thought, you know, maybe she was wise to take it slowly. So what did she gain by doing that?
Oh, okay. I think she was wise to take it slowly before they initiated the impeachment proceedings in the House.
I see.
I also think that, to my surprise, I was not in favor particularly of holding the articles back. I thought at the end she's going to have to turn them over. She's backed herself into a corner. And I didn't think that was very smart politically, frankly. It has actually turned out more promising so far. It's not resolved yet. But if she had sent the articles over immediately, I think she had no chance of getting witnesses. Now she has a chance because she's put the spotlight on this. And there are senators now, there are at least three senators who say they're open to conversations about witnesses. You need four to bring that vote about. Nancy Pelosi was not in the position to get that done before. She's in a much better position to get it now. And also, nobody could have anticipated the kind of flow of new evidence that has come in that fortifies the case against the president, and I think will bring some freshness to this. There was a real danger in these proceedings. It would just be all over again. We're going to go hear the same things again and again and again. And now there at least is something to look forward to because there's all these documents and potentially more documents to come. So it turned out better for her. And I think she is going to get a fairer fight than she had before.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, I'm having trouble imagining Mitch McConnell, who said recently that having to call additional witnesses doesn't show confidence in the House's case, and he doesn't want to do it until after essentially the cases have been presented. I'm trying to imagine how you said she backed herself in a corner.
Yes.
I'm trying to imagine how he backs himself out of that and allows witnesses, as you say, is now a possibility.
Well, he's, you know, to be fair to him, he has said all along what he stands for is the Clinton model of how to conduct this, and that is the decision on witnesses would be made during the trial, not before the trial.
But in the Clinton model, witnesses had at least opportunity to testify in the House.
No, exactly. I understand. I understand that difference.
But yeah, I figure you probably.
it's just common knowledge. So McConnell, if he loses the vote, and he might lose that vote, and you know, four Republicans, five Republicans, you know, break. He can say, look, that's what I said in the beginning. We're going to have I trust the Senate to operate with that. On the other hand, if she gets no votes, if there are no Republicans who break, it's going to be a proof that, holding back the articles for those few weeks actually didn't amount to much, and it does look like a defeat for her.
Let's go back to you used the word, I think, stonewalling of the White House. How bad was it?
It was terrible.
And explain that.
Absolutely terrible. I don't think – look, I was there during Watergate and working in the Nixon White House, just a young kid. And Richard Nixon, of all people, had people go up and testify. He turned over – I mean, John Dean – that's where the John Dean story came from. He was allowed to go testify. And Richard Nixon had the documents sent over. What he refused to do was give over the tapes, the voice tapes, the audio tapes. Because that's where once they became public, he would be doomed. But anyway, he was really open to the rest of this. And so we learned a lot long before the tapes came out. The tapes, of course, were ordered by the Supreme Court. And I think there was a very real chance that had the Democrats waited and gotten to the court, they might have won in the court. Might have won in the Supreme Court. I think they had a very strong argument.
If they had fought the subpoena, the resistance to the subpoenas.
Yeah, resistance to the subpoenas, and they would have been able to get Bolton and get Mulvaney and get others to go testify. And I think they would have eventually won that case. But it would have been a long time. And we might have gone all the way past the November 2020 elections.
You really think it could have been that long?
I don't think it easily could have been that long. I think there have been the Republicans would have found all sorts of stalling tactics. And very importantly, it's not just a question of, you know, in many ways, this should be left up to the voters at the end of the day. But if you give the Russians an easy play from now through the election, there's going to be a lot more disinformation. The Russians are going to be hacking in a lot of crazy places and trying to distort the elections. Who else may try to come in? The North Koreans and the Iranians.
How are we giving the Russians an easy play?
Because we're not – because the country is not mobilized to stop the Russians. And, you know, to learn, as we learned this week, which was stunning, that the Russians have hacked into Burisma. You know, the gas company in Ukraine, or Joe Biden's son, it was on the board and, you know, made a fair swatch of money. What were the Russians doing that if they were not trying to stir up our elections? They were looking for dirt on the Bidens. And maybe they're doing it to try to help their friend Donald Trump. Who knows?
So
but it's so suspicious that the Russians would be hacking Burisma.
And so that's another one. I mean, I just keep coming back to this. How bad is it we know the Russians have been trying to tamper with our elections?
I think it is unbelievably bad if you have a country that is not going to believe in the credibility of the vote. That is just – that can really rip apart a democracy, because people think if the whole system is indeed rigged and it's rigged in favor of our Russian friends, quote, that is going to be extremely disquieting. And I do think that getting this behind us and being able to move on to focusing more fully on ensuring we have fair elections is important. We've been waiting all the way through the election year and then – you know, and discovered after November, or here's my nightmare scenario, and that is on election day, three or four critical states will have breakdowns in their voting systems, and they'll be unable to resolve who won. You can't go to the Electoral College because you don't know who's got the, you know, because you've got three or four states outstanding. And the president says, well, in light of that, I'll just stay. I'll stay until this is resolved. That would put the country – we would just come unglued.
Talk about a constitutional crisis.
But that's my nightmare.
All right. So now that none of us are going to sleep tonight after you laid out that nightmare, how do we make sure as a country that nightmare doesn't happen in November 2020?
Well, one of the first big things you would assume if the White House was serious about it is that you would bring to Washington the heads of the election units across the country, the representatives of the states, and bring in your technologists and see what can be done on a rapid basis to make sure that this election is not penetrated by others. And, you know, I just don't think we're taking it seriously enough.
And if the White House doesn't take it seriously and do what you just said, is there any other body that can, so that the steps that need to be taken still
taken? Well, we have what's called a Federal Elections Commission, FEC, and that's supposed to be the watchdog for us on election procedures. Well, guess what? The government, the president, hasn't appointed the members, and we have a body that doesn't have enough. I don't think they've got a quorum at the FEC. It's going to be basically a toothless watchdog.
Could Congress get busy on that and fill
absolutely.
Up the FEC in the next
absolutely.
Couple of months?
We should be. What we know is that democracies around the world, including ours, are now under existential threat. Country after country. I'm a big fan of a book called Why Democracies Die. It was a book written by two Harvard professors. It's short, it's accessible, and it's a very, very fine work. But they point out that since the end of the Cold War, a dozen major countries had democracies. They elected strongmen. The strongmen took them down to authoritarianism. We see that in Turkey and Poland and Hungary. You can go down the list. But the fact is the United States is one of the strongest democracies, but even we are now having real problems with our politics and the lack of faith, the crumbling faith in the system itself. And I think that that's one of the great dangers of a second Trump term. One hopes that if he were reelected, he would be more sensible than that. But who can tell?
Do you believe the system can survive this?
I think, yes, I do think in the long term. I happen to be a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist.
I'll take it. That's David Gergen. He was an advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And he's the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he is a professor. Thank you so much for joining
us. Tiziana, thank you very much.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and the Red Sox are looking for a new manager. The team parted ways with manager Alex Cora last night after he was identified as one of the leaders in a sign-stealing scandal as bench coach of the Houston Astros. Major League Baseball is also investigating how the Red Sox used video replay in their 2018 championship season, Cora's first season managing the team. Today, Red Sox President Sam Kennedy and other team leaders discussed the decision for Cora to leave.
Professionally, it was ultimately an easy decision for the Red Sox and for Alex. It was a mutual decision. Alex came to the conclusion that he could not effectively lead the organization going forward in light of the commissioner's findings and the ruling. And we came to that conclusion as well.
WBUR's sports and society reporter, Shira Springer, was at Fenway for the press conference. She's joining us now. I'm just choked up about this, Shira.
A lot of people are. A lot of people are.
So tell me, one, really big emphasis on mutual decision today. What about that?
Yeah, that was one of the big takeaways from the press conference, which was basically, you know, a reporter actually asked, you know, so he was fired and Sam Kennedy stopped him. I believe it was Sam Kennedy and said, no, I want to make this clear. This was a mutual decision. This was a collaborative decision. There was a lot of emphasis on how everyone involved, and that would be owner John Henry and then chairman Tom Werner and Sam Kennedy and general manager Chaim Bloom, all came to this decision together, along with Alex. And they put a great deal of emphasis on, you know, how Alex was very contrite about what happened, that he talked to them and he admitted that he had done wrong and that, you know, he took personal responsibility and he did it in a very classy way. And, you know, at the end of all this, I think it was Chairman Tom Werner said, you know, listen, we think that Alex is a great guy. We're still very fond of Alex. And I think that was one of the surprising things, which was just how much, quite frankly, love there was for Alex Cora as a person in spite of what he had done as the Houston Astros bench coach.
So what's the short-term and long-term solution for a manager? I mean, we're a couple weeks till spring training. It's not like tons of people are on the market. So what are the Sox going to do?
Yeah, this is absolutely uncharted territory to be weeks away from the start of spring training. Pitchers and catchers report on February 11th. And to be searching for a manager, there are lots of unknowns, including will other teams, if you're looking at outside candidates, will other teams let you talk to their coaching staff at this point?
And you can't if they don't let you.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. You need permission from other teams to talk to potential manager candidates. Now, are they going to look internally? And Chaim Bloom, the current general manager, the new general manager,
yeah,
exactly, said, you know, yeah, we will look at internal candidates, but that could prove problematic because the Red Sox are still awaiting the results of MLB's investigation into the Red Sox sign-stealing scheme, the video replay scheme that happened during the 2018 season, or allegedly happened during the 2018 season. So we don't know if some of the current coaching staff will be implicated in that.
And so that might mean maybe not even be there.
Exactly. So do you look in turn? I mean, so there are lots of complications, but the biggest one is the time element. Chaim Bloom said he had no timetable at this point, but then Sam Kennedy on the side after the press conference finished, he said, listen, this is of the utmost urgency, obviously, because of the upcoming spring training. And as soon as we wrap up things here at the press conference, we are going immediately to talk about potential manager candidates.
Okay, so first regular season game is March 26th. Can the Sox be ready?
I don't think it's a question of being physically ready, right? I think, you know, the players have had training programs in place, you know, all during the offseason. They have been in contact with both Cora and the entire coaching staff. So physically, they know what they need to do and what's expected of them when they arrive in spring training. I think the bigger question is mentally. How much of a distraction is this for the team? If this lingers on, if there are, you know, there's some dislike of the manager that is ultimately hired, what happens? So it's more a question of mental, you know, issues like mental preparation. Can they all get on the same page strategically before the start of the season? Can they all feel good about each other, have that team chemistry that you want to have before the season starts? That's where the issues arise, not a physical readiness.
Okay, so last question for you. Cora also loomed large off the field, representing the Sox and the Boston community with our Puerto Rican community, for example. So how hard will it be for the Sox to find another manager that can have the impact off the field that Cora has had?
Yeah, I mean, let's be completely honest about this. Cora was absolutely one of a kind. And I say this having covered several Red Sox managers, been interviewed Cora one-on-one in his office. He really was one of a kind. I think we remember him most for his raising awareness of the victims of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and fighting to get aid down to Puerto Rico and actually bringing aid down to Puerto Rico. But I think also if we're going to talk about some of the off-the-field stuff, we want to just talk about his personality, his passion for the game, his ability to communicate with players, to make expectations clear. All of that, there is a very, very special skill set that not many people in baseball have. He was a unique talent. And quite frankly, everybody at the press conference said that. He was a unique talent as a manager, and he's going to be very hard to replace on the field and off the field.
All right, WBUR Sports Society reporter Shira Springer, thanks.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit more about Cora off the field. He used his role as Red Sox manager to bring attention to his home country of Puerto Rico. For reaction from the Puerto Rican community to his departure, we welcome in Simon Rios from WBUR. Simon, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
So in general, what did Cora do for the Puerto Rican community?
So before taking the job, as Shira alluded to, he requested that the team make an aid mission to the island. He arrived. We actually went down with them. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was there, several team members, and nearly 10 tons of supplies and $200,000 to help the town fix its electric grid. You know, I remember kids from a local Little League team lining up and getting baseball gear from Chris Sale, Rick Porcello, and Christian Vasquez, who's, of course, from Puerto Rico. You know, getting hired in Boston, seeing Alex Cora get this major job, it was a win for the Latino community. The first manager of color on the Red Sox, and then going on to win a World Series. However tainted that may prove to be in hindsight, I spoke to a Puerto Rican activist in Boston today, Otoniel Figueroa Duran. He's from Caguas, the same region of Puerto Rico where Cora is from. And he told me how much the World Series win meant to him.
When Boston won the World Series, the first thing that Alex did was to ask to bring the trophy to Puerto Rico. And we were in that pain of the Hurricane Maria reconstruction, and he brings the trophy, people receive the team, people receive Alex Cora. He, in the parade, in the Boston parade, right, he was with his flag, Puerto Rican flag, proud of where he came from. So, right, I wanted to make sure, right, that the people captured the meaning of Alex Cora for us.
You know, then he also told me about the somewhat divisive invite to President Trump's White House after the World Series win. And Figueroa says that Puerto Rico, you know, really felt abandoned by the president after the hurricane. So by refusing to go to the White House, along with some of the team members, he saw Cora as really standing up to the Trump administration.
So let me ask you what the reaction of the community's been to the Sox decision, the mutual decision between the Sox and Cora for Cora to leave.
You know, it's obviously not monolithic. Some people kind of have this he cheated, he's got to go mentality. And on the other end, some people say he shouldn't have been punished at all. It was premature. But I think more than anything, there's a sense of sadness among at least the Puerto Ricans and Latinos that I spoke to. I visited a barber shop where Big Papi has been known to get his hair cut on occasion. And I spoke to a Dominican barber named Ramon Martes. Let's hear from him.
Es un latino que está representando a Latinoamérica entera y juega, hay muchos dominicanos que juegan ahí.
So he's saying how proud he was to have a Latino in such a position, that it's not about being Dominican or Puerto Rican. It's about being Latino and from the Caribbean. Martes says he doesn't blame Cora for what he is charged with doing. He doesn't think it makes him a bad person. The most important thing Cora did, he says, was come to Boston and turn, frankly, a mediocre team into a championship team.
Okay, Simone, and in our last few seconds, some people you spoke with were upset about how the Sox handled this. Is that right?
Absolutely. So Otoniel Figueroa Duran, who we heard from before, says given everything that the island's been through, you know, the hurricane and the current crisis set off by earthquakes hitting the island, that it's a real blow to see Cora fall like this in really bad timing.
We're not saying that what he did, if he did what they allegedly say, was right, because it altered the purity of baseball, and that's a very controversial thing to do, of course. And it was tainted, the championship and all that, but more to the point is that people deserve second chance, and Alex Cora, Boston Red Sox turned their back on Alex, and we're very disappointed with the team.
I'll say, Tiziana, that from the Red Sox point of view, they say the decision to part with Cora was based off the conclusion of Major League Baseball's investigation into the Astros' sign-stealing when Cora was a bench coach. But the team's owner, CEO, and chairman said in a statement that they'll miss Cora's passion and that they'll miss his significant contributions to New England and to Puerto Rico.
Well, WBUR, Simone Rios, thanks for bringing those voices today. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. We're going to bring you analysis of last night's 2020 Democratic presidential debate. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is just 19 days until the first votes in the Democratic presidential primary begin with the Iowa caucus. Last night, the top six remaining Democratic presidential candidates — that's actually not fair — the top six who made the debate from the remaining Democratic presidential candidates took the stage in Des Moines, Iowa, for the final debate before the caucus on February 3rd. Here with me in Studio 3 to break it all down is former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Representative Capuano, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Also with us here is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
And on the line with us is Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Jennifer, thanks for joining us again.
Nice to be here.
We also have you, so call and share your thoughts as well. What did you make of last night's debate? Did you watch? If you haven't watched yet, did you decide to watch this time? Have any of the candidates managed to separate themselves from the pack? Let us know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, Congressman and Michael, I'll start with you as the two Democrats in the room. The biggest thoughts or takeaways from last night, Congressman?
I never thought a handshake could be so important. that's really the biggest takeaway. I mean, I don't think anything else changed last night. It was a relatively uneventful debate. I really think that based on everybody I've talked to both yesterday and today, I think America is ready to get this done. Let's get going. Let's have some votes and see where it goes then. We'll come back a little while later and maybe watch a few more debates.
And do you think that break that we witnessed with the lack of handshake between Sanders and Warren last night is real or matters?
It could matter. I'd have no idea whether it's real. And I actually thought that BUI would hire their own lip reader and let us know what was actually said.
They should have done that. Michael, what about you? Reactions?
So, you know, it's funny. I'm as a policy person, I'm always listening for policy, and it's so hard when the field is so large and it's whittled down now. So I would characterize it as ankle deep to knee deep now. So a little bit more on health care, wealth tax, a little conversation. I think those of us who are listening to differentiate the candidates got a little bit more than we've gotten previously. Two, you know, I saw trending on social media was debate so white, like Oscar so white. I think that it matters to us that we've been pleased by the diversity in this campaign cycle and the conversation being rich with diversity, and that was lacking last night as well. Interestingly enough, in the last election cycle, the GOP had two candidates of color at this stage where we have none at this point on the stage. That brings up the issue of whether the qualifications are really fair and
for the debates
and more people should have access.
Okay, before we turn to Jennifer, I want to just ask you one quick follow-up on that, Michael, because I also noticed that there were no candidates of color on stage. And there were a number of subjects that weren't on stage. Immigration, gun control, criminal justice reform. I point those out because they figured front and center in, or at least largely, in other debates, but they weren't there last night.
Absolutely. I think what happens typically if you have candidates who are white or predominant candidates, they'll have conversations that, of course, apply to all of us. If you're talking about universal pre-K and education and what can be done with a wealth tax, all of that is something we'd all be interested in. But what we were listening for as listeners and voters of color are the direct issues that we care about, because we get often get left out of the conversation. That, as you said, immigration issues, even issues around the disparities that exist and racism. That's gone at this point, and we probably won't hear much of it going forward.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Did you hear the issues you were looking for last night? And as Michael said, did we go from ankle deep to knee deep? Are you ready for waist deep? What are you not hearing yet that you think is important? Join the conversation. Pull up a chair at the table. So, Jennifer, I'll turn to you now as an observer. Any winners or losers from your perspective last night?
From my perspective, I really see Joe Biden solidifying his position as the front runner. And then in another lane, I see Senator Sanders and Senator Warren competing for who that challenger is going to be for Biden going forward. So I think what's going to happen is that Biden will probably not win the Iowa caucuses. He may not win the New Hampshire primary, but he's leading in the polls in some of the other early states and nationally. So I think what's going to – and he's in for the long haul. So I think Warren and Sanders are really fighting for that person who's going to come in first in Iowa, and then that person will be – the foil for Biden going forward, and it will become a race between two people. So part of what you saw last night between Sanders and Warren is a fight for that position.
Congressman, what do you think of that?
I think that's a little bit it's not taking into account Michael Bloomberg's efforts on Super Tuesday. I think we have another month before this thing gets settled. More clearer anyway. I think America is just starting to tune in to this. We've had give or take 6 million viewers of these things. I didn't see last night's numbers.
I haven't seen them either.
But all the other numbers in that range. I mean, it's just not a lot. That's a lot, but it's not a lot comparatively. And that being the case, I think little by little, America's tuning in. They'll tune in more once there's an election, one vote or two votes. Iowa will not make a break much. It'll maybe cut the field a little bit more. New Hampshire might not. I think everybody's going to have to hold their breath until Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday, I think this year, is a much more important election day than it has been in the past.
I don't think I can hold my breath.
I don't disagree with that. I actually don't. But what I'm saying is that although most of America might not be tuning in, Iowans are. And so somebody's going to come in first in Iowa, and that person, by virtue of coming in first in Iowa, is going to solidify a lot of funding and a lot of endorsements. And that person is, just by the nature of the process, going to come out as the leader of the anti-Biden wing. That's just what's going to happen. And the media is going to play into that and make it essentially, at that point, I think, a two-person race between Biden and that person. That may change on Super Tuesday, but that's what was happening, in my view, in this debate. And that's what's going to happen in the next few
Congressman.
Weeks.
I don't think either Warren or Sanders is going to go away that fast. I think they're going to stick it out at least for the first four, if not all the way through to Super Tuesday. I certainly think that it might begin that conversation. I don't think anybody of significance is going away, any of those four large candidates. I think you might knock out some of the others, and you got to keep Bloomberg online. And I actually think, depending what happens, you might actually open the door at some future point for somebody else, like a Deval Patrick type of candidate.
Michael, you've been nodding through a bunch of that.
Yeah, so funny. I agree with the Congressman mostly. I think the reality is people, as I talk to voters in other states and even here in Massachusetts, people expect the vice president to falter at some point. Many of the people I talk to are not super Biden fans of him becoming president. They like him. They like his years with Obama. But he's the candidate because they feel he can beat Trump. At any point that changes, people will switch tracks and select another candidate if they believe that candidate has some traction.
So are you saying that a lot of Biden's support is not because he's Biden, but because he seems like the right horse to back?
We are so traumatized by this presidency. People just want the candidate that they think will defeat Trump and take the White House. And particularly, I'll kind of hone in on African-American voters. you will see an exodus of many African-American voters if there is another viable candidate that people believe speaks to their issues and has a chance to win. I do, and I'm familiar with the Deval Patrick campaign. I know former Governor Patrick well. I wouldn't count him out. If you know, he catches some steam and folks pay attention to him, he's an amazing speaker. He knows the policy issues. He has a story to tell. So I think we have a while to go before this is settled.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to bring a caller into this. Lisa, you clearly tuned in last night. Lisa and Waltham, why don't you bring your voice into this? Go ahead.
Sure. I don't agree with your panel at all.
All right, then.
I believe that Biden is not going to last. I believe that, and I'm 55 and I'm a progressive, but don't take that as why I'm poo-pooing Biden. I think he did not sound well. I don't think he was strong. I think his affect was strong in his closing statements, but he did not have a he did not have a good debate. Anytime he talked about tech, this is where you saw Andrew Yang was so sorely missed. Anytime he talked about tech, he just sounded like he did not know what he was talking about.
All right, Lisa,
I think the women came out super strong. I think Andrew Yang and the other candidates of color were sorely missed because then, as your other panel, other members of your panel said, certain issues do not get brought up there.
All right, Lisa, I'm going to take it back from there. I'm actually going to turn to Jennifer Beceris on this. What's your reaction, Jennifer?
So I first want to react to what my friend Michael Curry said, and I agree that Biden's main selling point has been electability, right? In fact, you saw that last night. He made that as his primary pitch for getting elected, and you know, we can agree to disagree on whether that's a good reason to vote for somebody or not, but certainly that's been his pitch. Where I disagree with Michael Curry is on the notion that somebody else will eventually present themselves as being as electable as Biden. I don't think that will happen. I've spoken with a lot of lifelong Democrats who are not from the progressive wing of the party but do consider themselves to be liberals. And a couple of them have told me that if either Warren or Sanders gets the nomination, they will stay home for the first time in their lives. And these are middle-aged people who take voting very seriously. They will not be able to pull the trigger for somebody who's a Democratic socialist.
All right, so let me pick it up from there, actually, and take this in a little in a new direction. To what extent did we see any sorting out of moderate to progressive and where this party, the Democratic Party, is going to come out in this race last night, Congressman?
I don't think you saw any more than you've seen. I mean, more of the same for the most part. I don't recall anything that really shocked me by anybody. I said, oh my gosh, I didn't know that candidate believed this issue. I think people have it, for the people that have been paying attention, have it pretty well sorted out of where people fit on that left-right spectrum in the Democratic Party. And I do think that knowing that, I still think that a lot of people still want to find somebody who comes closest to their perspective and they believe honestly can win. And that is that's the big issue that's going forward. And that's going to continue for a while. I don't see it sorting itself out for a while. I would like it to, so we can focus on Mr. Trump. But I just think that's asking too much.
So, Michael, I'm going to play two cuts here that came from the foreign policy portion of the debate last night. First is Senator Bernie Sanders talking about the worst foreign policy decisions of our lifetime.
The two great foreign policy disasters of our lifetimes were the war in Vietnam and the war in Iraq. Both of those wars were based on lies. And right now, what I fear very much is we have a president who is lying again and could drag us into a war that is even worse than the war in Iraq.
And then we have Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, talking about a different perspective and the generational difference on foreign policy.
There are enlisted people that I served with barely old enough to remember those votes on the authorization after 9/11, on the war in Iraq. And there are people now old enough to enlist who were not alive for some of those debates.
Now, there's a lot in there. There's like eight different things about foreign policy we could talk about. But one thing that I want to pull out as we talk about where the party is going to settle out is Sanders talked about the two great foreign policy disasters of our lifetimes being Iraq and Vietnam. And then Pete Buttigieg saying a lot of people weren't even alive for 9/11.
Right.
So those are two very different perspectives on the lifetime perspective a voter brings to who can lead. How is that playing out through this primary process?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the debate. It is, as many of us are concerned with our tensions with Iran right now, and I am not confident, and I'd be curious to hit a congressman on this too, that you could trust Donald Trump on anything that would have justified the assassination of their lieutenant, a leader. I do feel like that's a legitimate conversation to have, that we've been here before. We give way too much deference to our elected officials, in this case to the White House, to initiate war without the authorization or involvement of Congress. Generations are just removed from some of this stuff. But the young people I talk to are familiar that government acted inappropriately with or incorrectly with Vietnam. We did it again with Iraq. And they're paying attention now to what's happening in Iran.
So, Congressman, Michael asked kind of what did you think on Iran? Let me just ask you about that and the president's sort of trustworthiness there.
The president's trustworthiness, I think, is undebatable, or the lack thereof is undebatable. I've been thinking about the Iran thing. Look, I sued both George Bush and Barack Obama on what I thought was inappropriate, illegal, and unconstitutional use of presidential power. And I lost both cases, actually, because the Supreme Court refuses to take up the War Powers Act in a court of law. But I couldn't agree more. And it's every president. This president is probably the least trustworthy president. So with all of the presidential abuses before him, this is the most dangerous. And that's before or after the killing of the Iranian. The killing of the Iranian in and of itself was a real concern. I think that concern, I won't say it's passed, but it seems to have significantly subsided on a worldwide level. And I actually think in final analysis that might end up helping Donald Trump. I hate to say that, but from a political perspective, not from a policy one, not from a historical one.
We're talking politics.
But pure politics, I think the average American will say, look, this guy was a bad guy. There's no question about that. He did have bloody hands when it came to American lives, never mind non-American lives, which was innocent as well. So that, I mean, it's awfully hard to defend not killing him. However, risking World War to do it, I think, is a better question. And again, since it's worked out, my expectation is that debate will have to wait till a later time. With the split House and Senate, you're not going to get a unified Congress who will stand up tall. They didn't do it with George Bush. They didn't do it with Barack Obama. They're unlikely. They certainly don't seem to be going to be doing it now. I look forward to the day that Congress actually enforces what I consider to be a constitutional mandate that war and peace is decided by the Congress. Not because the Congress it knows everything. Mm-hmm. I think because the Congress represents everybody and will probably be a little bit more cautious than an individual who might get upset that a foreign leader called his daddy a bad name or what's politically beneficial.
So, Jennifer Peceres, I want to stay on foreign policy for a minute and ask you a little bit different question. One might argue that historically, Republicans would go into general elections wearing the mantle of being strong on foreign policy. Will that be the case this time? And or was there a Democratic candidate you saw on stage last night who might claim the mantle of foreign policy in a general election?
That is a very good question, because I think what you saw in 2016 was a bit of a realignment, a political realignment, where, traditional hawks, many of whom were neoconservatives or Republicans from other administrations in the foreign policy arena, lined up behind Hillary Clinton. And a lot of isolationists and people who are more dove-like in their approaches to foreign policy went with Donald Trump. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now. I mean, you do see a lot of Trump supporters saying, not a lot, but you see some Trump supporters criticizing him for going back on his promises to bring the troops home and to not embroil ourselves in entanglements abroad in the Middle East. And I do think it's possible that somebody like Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden could sort of take on that more hawkish mentality that more hawkish position that Hillary Clinton occupied. So the question is, where are the voters going to go, and how do the voters feel about it? I definitely think there was a realignment in 2016. I don't know that it stuck.
Okay, so I've got about 30 seconds left. So, Michael Curry, I'll turn to you for one more quickly. Yep. What are you looking for between now and Iowa?
Well, I think, you know, folks are going to be on the ground. So it's really, the senators have to go back and engage in this process in the Senate on impeachment. So it's going to be a draw of attention. Typically, you'll see candidates holding their campaign rallies, really doing the work on the ground. They're going to have to rely on their teams to do that. I know many of the other candidates that I've talked to, and I'm unfortunate that Corey's out of the race because I got a chance to talk to him quite a bit. But the rest will be on the ground really trying to generate some support.
All right. That's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the national board. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Michael Capuano, former 10-term U.S. congressman from Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cecilia.
Jennifer Braceras, political analyst and senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.